accession number 20849, reel 2.
Tom Packman, reel 2.
So we rushed over this bridge and he let fly at a gun emplacement which was on the right hand side of the bridge as we went over. Our next objective was to cross over the road and up towards the cafe, the garden, back garden of the cafe, which was on the other side of the road. We eventually got up there and we found a small indent in the ground, which we thought, well, this will save us having to dig a slit trench. So we got down in this little indent in the ground. About half an hour or so later, we heard tank tracks. And we thought, oh dear, we've got nothing to stop tanks. And anyway, we heard this tank. It was about, I suppose, about 30 yards from us. We were on, up on the bank of the, behind the Gondre Cafe, and the road was about 25 or 30 yards to our right. And all of a sudden, this tank stopped, and obviously we found out later that a Piat had been fired at it, which had disabled the tank. And all the ammunition in this tank was then exploding all night. And we didn't know that at the time. We thought, well, there's certainly a battle going on somewhere. But it was just this ammunition in this tank which was going up all the while. The second tank obviously decided not to proceed any further, and that retreated back into the village and, you know, left it till daylight. Number seven para should have come to relieve us more or less as soon after we landed. But they were so spread out that I think the first one got to us about 2:30 in the morning. And then eventually they started to creep in. And by about 3:30 in the morning, enough of them had come for us to be withdrawn back to the other side of the bridge to occupy trenches on the other side of the bridge. And so then 7 para took over that front line up that in La Pont and Benneville. Of course, as it got daylight, that's when the problems started, because they could see us from the snipers who had obviously got into position during the night could see us. And they were, well, they weren't picking us up, but they were quite a few people got hit, but not killed. And so we were very dubious about moving about in the daylight. We had to go. John Howard sent a section up into La Pont to help the 7 para out, because they were getting a bit bogged down. So a section went up, which included me, Bill Gray, Bill Bailey, and a few more. And we went into La Pont to help them out for a little while. Then eventually we came back again.
What did you do in La Pont?
Well, we took up positions in houses, and we got quite a bit of street fighting going on in between the Germans and the 7 para. And we were just occupying different houses to deny them to the enemy.
Did you fire your weapon?
Oh, yes, we fired once or twice at them as they were trying to cross over the road into different different houses, yeah. Anyway, eventually that problem got solved, but unbeknown to us, the Germans had broken into a first aid room, which was, I think it was about 7 or 8 wounded parachutists in there, 7 para in there, and the Germans broke in and shot the lot of them, including the padre. And that they're all buried in Benneville Churchyard. So after that, you know, it quietened down a bit, but you didn't venture out much. But then eventually, I think about I was 12, quarter to one lunchtime, we heard the bagpipe coming. Well, we thought it must be on our side, because no one had told us anyone was coming up that way. We didn't know. But, I mean, Howard probably did. But anyway, eventually Lord Lovett and the commandos arrived at the other side of the bridge. And we shouted at them to run across, to get across quickly, because you know, they were being shot at on the bridge. And one or two didn't, and I'm afraid one or two of them got killed on the bridge. But the piper, he stopped piping at the far end of the bridge, and he ran across. As he said to us afterwards, he said, no way can you play the bagpipes and run. So he said he got across the bridge, and then he didn't open up, start again, until he was halfway between the two bridges. And there we held that position till, well, during the evening, the main body arrived from England. The rest of the 6th Airborne Division arrived by gliders and parachutes and landed all around the Ranville area. By that time, it had quieted down where we were. And by 9:30 in the evening, the Warwicks had arrived from the beaches, and they took over the whole of the our area, and off we moved on towards Herivalet. We then bunked down in a field overnight. The next morning we went into Herivalet, which was empty. We were then pushed forward into the next village, which was Escaville, which when we got there was empty, but unbeknown to us, just the other side of the hill was a lot of German infantry and Tiger tanks, which we were stationed up a track. It was a track, big trees, and all of a sudden a load of cows were driven down this track, and the Germans behind them. But I mean, we couldn't. We had to withdraw back because we couldn't get in. The cows had trampled us to death. So we drew back to round the end, bottom of the road, and Bill Gray and I and our section took up position behind this big farmyard roller, a big roller which they used to roll the fields. And the Germans started to run down this track across the road to our right, and our section commander said, right, we're getting out of this, you two stop here and cover us. So Gray and I stayed there. He let fly a few times at the Germans running across the road, and obviously we found out afterwards he got quite a few of them. And then I said to Bill, come on, we've got to get out of here. And we got out and came to a wall, about a 10-foot wall, which we had to climb over with a Bren gun. We got over there, I think it was three of us that got over there somewhere or other, and eventually got back to Herivalet, where we were pushed into defensive positions from where we stayed for many days.
When the piper arrived with Lord Lovett, what did you feel about his playing?
Well, we were pleased to hear it, actually, to know that we had someone on our side. And I mean, after that, they went on through to take up their position wherever they were going, up to Ampleville, I think. And later on, I got the Black Watch Regiment, and that came through and things like that. And lots of other troops came through, plus, which we didn't know what was happening because we'd gone from there.
What was the fighting like at Herivalet?
There was none at Herivalet. Escaville was pretty dodgy. But we lost quite a few men at Escaville. But by the time we got back to defensive positions, the Germans obviously thought they'd taken Escaville back, and that's where they stayed. And so we just took up, we were probably about, I don't know, 300 yards away from them. We were in these big hedgerows with the big trees, and they were about another 300 yards away in trees. And all of them, later on, I don't know how many days it was, they certainly tried going to counterattack.
What kind of fire were the men lost to at Escaville?
By sniper fire and machine gun fire.
Did you account for any of the snipers?
We didn't. We didn't have any in our area. We just had the Germans running down the track. The snipers had sounded over both ends of Escovelin, tall buildings. You know, tall buildings were just a slot. That's where the snipers were. We found out many years later that a lady that we got to know who had a cafe at the top of Escovelin, the Germans had a platform up in a big tree. And he obviously shot one of our men up in Escovelin churchyard. One of them was killed there, but somebody else shot him out of the tree. And we heard afterwards that he hadn't hardly hit the ground before the French people had the boots off, took his boots off, because he had some very nice boots on. Yes, we lost quite a few men at D Company did at Escovelin. And then from really quietened down, we then moved about from there to... They put in, we went out to them then to Breville. By that time, there's one section in my platoon had lost a lance corporal killed and the corporal injured. So I was then made up to corporal to take over that section, which is the same section that Eddie Edwards was in. And we then moved to Breville. There was a very heavy raid put on Breville by the artillery and the ships out in the sea, because it seemed Chateau Saint-Con was a heavily defended high piece of ground. And we were then doubled up by about 3:40 in the morning, doubled up to take over this, after this heavy shelling, to take over these positions at Chateau Saint-Con. And when we got there, there were so many dead Germans, we didn't know, they were dead in their trenches. And most of them never had a scratch. They were just killed by concussion.
From artillery?
From the artillery. And so we just dumped them out of the trenches and took the trenches over, because they were expecting another, probably a counter-attack in the morning, in their first light. But nothing came of it. And so started to clear up down there, and we hung on there for some time. We got Strafe One supplies with one solitary German plane used to come over every now and again. And we used to go out on patrols, and we knew the Germans were only about 200 yards in front of us, but we never knew how strong they were. They never bothered us, so we never bothered them. Well, the snipers used to go out and pick up one or two of them now and again. But this plane would have come over eventually, because my section, we were in a big trench, and beyond the trench was a big tree which had been cut down, and just, you know, the base, which we used for our table, for our mess tins and mugs. And it came down this hedgerow one day and shot up, and we had one or two holes in mess tins and mugs from this German plane. Because it used to go down, I think, to attack the bridge area as well afterwards.
Was there much support from the RAF?
Well, yeah, but we could hear the RAF, or I think, well, what are the typhoons? You could hear them about, you know. I mean, the day that we landed on the Pegasus Bridge, in the morning, just getting light, a plane flew up the canal. We didn't know what it was at the time, whether it was German Messerschmitt, and it turned out to be a Spitfire. And it flew low over the bridge area and dropped a package on the other side. So John Howard sent someone out to retrieve this package, and it turned out to be the newspaper. I think it was a Daily Mirror, wrapped in a brick. And, of course, it just to say that D-Day had started. But all my men were interested in those days. There used to be a cartoon in the paper, Jane, and those were one of these here models, you know. And they were more or less interested in what she had on or what she didn't have on. The war was of no consequence, really. All they wanted to look at was a paper. On the 50th anniversary, I got involved for giving an interview to the BBC, and the commentator said, Tom, a funny thing happened, and I told him this instance. And then they went back to Raymond Baxter in London, who Raymond Baxter told the British people and everything what it was all about, what Jane was all about, and what this particular day was, where she was going for a bath, and the local landlord wanted to know if she'd like to come in and scrub her back, and he said, oh no, she had a louver. And then they come back, seen this girl sat in the corner on this plinth, and then we have Jane here. And there was this little woman, about 5'10", and that's the woman who would have been Jane.
5'10"?
25, only a little fat thing, she was, yeah.
You mean 4'10"?
Mm. No, 5'10". Yeah. Well, yeah. No, we're 5'9" or something like that. She was smaller than me. And this little girl stood up, and this turned out to be Jane, the one who was at, and she told her she'd had 63 proposals of marriage. Then she finished up marrying an RAF man, but she died about a couple of years ago.
What do you remember happening next? You were talking about this German aeroplane.
Well, yes, it went over and just shot up some of it, but I don't know what happened to him. I think that was the last time we saw it. I know it went over, it did drop a bomb or something on the Pegasus Bridge, but it seemed the bomb didn't go off, landed in the canal. And, after that, we just hung around there till they decided to move out. I think it was about August when they broke out from Caen, and we broke out from the Chateau St. Comair and made our way all up to Deauville, Touville, Touques, and finished up on the Seine.
What had been your living conditions in the field in Normandy?
Oh, just living in a trench, dug into a bank.
Was it uncomfortable?
Yes, it was very uncomfortable, but, you know, you made them comfortable.
Oh.
Well, went into the houses and got a bit of carpet or a bit of blanket, you know, and made something about it. The man who was my lance corporal in Breville, he was a big man, about 6 foot something, Felix Clive. And when we were in Breville, he got a big barrel, a big wine barrel, which he dug into his trench. And he had a little net over it, you know, to stop the mosquitoes in when he was not standing too. One particular day, me and him had decided to go into some houses which were about 50 yards behind us to see what we could find, you know. And we went into a shed, and there was this big barrel. Now, he was a farmer. I didn't know at the time, but he had his parents had their own fruit farms in Gloucestershire. And he said, oh, you know, cider. So we tried some of this. Oh, he said, this is rubbish. But unbeknown to us, it was Calvados. But we had one or two sips of it. And then all of a sudden they started to shell. So we rushed back to our trenches. And mine happened to be the nearest one, so we both dived into my trench. When it was all over, we got up, and a shell had dropped into his trench and blew the barrel and everything to pieces. It was just by luck that we fell into my trench and not into his. And so we then the platoon had to get round to dig out his trench. And Eddie Edwards was one of them men who was digging that trench out. But he had the wrong man in his book. He's got the wrong man. He said, a bloke named Gardner, but his name was Felix Clive, who was in that particular trench.
So you get these carpets and things from abandoned houses?
Abandoned houses, yeah.
Did it make it comfortable?
Oh, yes, it made it quite comfortable, yeah.
Did you suffer much from the mosquitoes?
No, I don't think so, you know. I mean, only your face and your hands are exposed anyway. You know, you weren't running around bare-chested and things like that. You had all your gear on all the while. So it was only your hands, but I can't remember even getting bitten by, I suppose I must have done, but I don't remember suffering any. I think one or two of them suffered pretty badly with them, but they didn't bother me all that much.
Any contact with civilians in Normandy?
No, none at all. Never saw one.
Could you get any food from the land?
Oh yes, they used to go out in the field and dig up potatoes and things like that, you know, out of the field and bring them back for the local, for the platoon cooking, or swede or something like that, or whatever, turnip, which they used to cook up.
What did you think to the way the German enemy fought in Normandy?
Well, they were pretty, you know, tenacious. I mean, they were fighting just the same as we were, really. Yeah. I mean, the ones on the bridge, I mean, when we landed on the bridge, there was two sentries. Well, they just run off. We never saw no more of those. I think they gave themselves up the next morning, but they just run off down the canal out of the way.
Did you take any prisoners?
Oh, we got quite a few prisoners when it got daylight, because they were then fetching them out of their dugouts. They thought it was an exercise going on. They didn't realise the war had started. And so they had to, in fact, people went into their trenches and fired Sten guns under the beds to wake them up, to get them up. We did hear, I don't know whether it was a rumour or what, but it seems that one of them had been 21 on the 5th of June, and they'd been celebrating in the Gondre Cafe. And so I had quite a lot to drink. And of course, 11 o'clock was curfew. Everybody had to be out off the street by 11:30, otherwise they were shot. So all the troops were in their bunks and fast asleep probably by the time we arrived. And nobody took a lot of notice, I don't think. But
how were the prisoners treated?
All right, yes, as far as I know, yes, yeah. I didn't have anything to do with them. Yeah. They were just huddled together in between the two bridges, on the track in between the two bridges, and that was there. They were guarded, obviously, by someone from probably Platoon HQ, I don't know who.
Was the Normandy campaign harder or easier than you had expected?
It was a lot harder, yeah. After the initial first day was easy. It was like being on a scheme. But after that, it became quite difficult. Because we fought away right from when we broke out at Shadowstone. We were taking all different villages and that, and different bridges. There's different bridges. There's one at Tuke's named the Oxenbox Bridge, which is another bridge we had to take there. And we lost quite a few odd men on the way up until we got to the same, which are buried in different cemeteries on the way up there.
Did you get wounded or injured in Normandy?
I never got a scratch all the way through the war. I went through that campaign right to the Seine, back to England, and then we were waiting for Christmas Day, and we were shipped out to the Ardennes.
Let's pick up, go back to the narrative, because you were heading towards the Seine when we last left.
Yeah.
What happened then?
That's it, we got up to the Seine, and that was it. The Germans by that time were all over the other side, and we couldn't do anything else. We just took up positions there, and we went, I don't know how long we were there, not long, I don't think, before we were then bussed back to Arromanches, and then over the Moorbury Harbour and boated back to England. But when we got there, it was so rough that you would jump, climb onto the boats up scramble necks. And the scramble necks, the boat was so rough that they had to cancel it because two of the Devons got killed when they got squashed against the side of the pier of the Moorbury Harbour. So it was cancelled for 2 days before we could board the boats to get back to Southampton and then back into Bulford, whereby a few of the men who had been injured on the operation were still back in their beds, but of course a few vacant spaces in the barrack room.
How did you all feel once you got back to England?
Oh, very nice. But it was, you know, once again, good to think that, you know, the man who was in the bed next to you would never be coming back, and the one across from you had gone. But you got so hardened to it that, you know, you never... But we, in Chateau St. Combe, the CQMS got killed, Mr. Charlie, CQMS Flexham. A bomb dropped on his trench and he was killed. And when they were carrying him away, one of his arms was hanging off the stretcher and it was swinging away backwards and forwards. And the boy said, "Look at that, regimental to the last." They said, "Get as bad as that, you know. A man would get shot next to you," and that was it.
So you stayed in England from August until you went to the Ardennes?
Yes, well, because they had to reinforce us with other people, you know, to make us up again, and we had to train them. And we were still looking forward to Christmas in England. And the Battle of the Bulge commenced in December, and they broke through more or less where the Americans were, the 81st, 82nd and 101st Airborne, which were where there was no armour and nothing. They came through there, and so the 6th Airborne were sent over to help them out. But I must admit, we got over there and I never saw a German. And most of my platoon never saw a German. So, you know, and we were there, came back again in February.
You were talking about those reinforcements you got in England. Mm. What can you tell me about them?
Well, they came from different regiments, I think. Still, you know, obviously volunteers. I think some of them were from the Essex. Where the others came from, I don't really know.
How did they fit in?
Well, they had to, you know, because it's a matter of that if you... Because being in the airborne, you're in the air, you've got an extra shilling a day. I mean, when you was on 7 shillings a week basic, you got another 7 shillings, you had a 50%, 100% rise. But if you didn't qualify, you were sent back to your unit. If you didn't come up to scratch, and there was one or two and did get sent back to units. But you had...
Difficult to qualify?
Well, it was, I suppose, in the first place, you know. But after you'd been through it, you know, it wasn't... You got easy. It was the rest of them who had to qualify for it, to come up to... Because John Howard wasn't in charge of us then. He had had an accident, so... another man had taken charge of the company, so it probably wasn't as strict as it probably would have been if Howard had still been in charge of us.
Did you see him have the accident?
No. Well, he had an accident. He was going home after we got back in the August. He was going home to see his wife, who lived in Oxford. He was going home with his own Jeep and his own driver, but I gather that it said that the driver wasn't going fast enough for John, so John took over driving. Going down through a village called Hurstbourne Tarrant, he seemed to going round the corner and run smack bang into an American tank transporter. which broke both his legs and his pelvis, and so that finished John's army career.
What kind of living conditions did you have in the Ardennes?
We were billeted in people's houses. And in fact, the air conditions are quite good.